welcome to Our Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today, Ross Mitchell. He is the executive director of a hidden gem here in the Philadelphia area, Glen Ford, a beautiful jewel of an historic residence. Welcome, Ross.
Thank you very much, Laura. Nice to be here.
Did I manage to convey the fabulousness of this estate?
That was a good start.
Good start.
We can elaborate on that.
Okay. Well, then let's hear about it. What is Glen Ford?
Glen Ford is an 1850-ish. We don't have the exact date of its construction, but it was somewhere between 1850 and 1853. A historic mansion, and it was built right on the banks of the Delaware by Charles McAllister. And Charles McAllister was a financier, Scottish heritage. His father was from Scotland, and his father was a shipping magnate. So he had a whole fleet of ships, and when trade with Europe and with England was very, very much the way to go, he made a fortune, and his son inherited the money and became a financial advisor to, I believe, five different presidents. Charles McAllister was the first president of the Second Bank of the United States under Andrew Jackson, and he had a house in Washington. He had a house in Center City, Philadelphia. He had a house in Chestnut Hill. And, then he bought 85 acres in Tacony, or in Torsdale, and built this beautiful, it's now 30,000 square feet mansion, but it wasn't quite that when he originally built it. So this area of Torsdale, right at the very edge of the city of Philadelphia, of course, it was not part of Philadelphia in 1850. How do I describe it? It was a gentleman's retreat. It was an area where a gentleman, quote unquote, from Center City would take the ferry up and they would fish and hunt. And there was a casino there, too, and the hotel. And it was like a resort area. It's really, really kind of an interesting history for this area.
So the rich, the magnates and the wealthy families would have an estate in Torsdale?
Yes. Yeah. Andalusia. The Biddle family residence is like half a mile, maybe a mile up the river from us. And, you know, it's still owned by the Biddle family, and they have over 100 acres there, I believe. So it was very much a wealthy area of the city, being right on the river. So, you know, this is, you know, before the heavy industrialization of the area. In fact, you know, Glen Ford and the house two doors away, I believe the house two doors away is the only private residence right on the river in Philadelphia. And Glen Ford, I believe, is the only publicly owned mansion on the riverfront, because everything else is industrial.
You just mentioned to me that Glen Ford is owned by the city, and it's part of Fairmount Park, but we'll get into that. But is this one of the few surviving along the river? I can't think of another one, because Andalusia is not actually on the river, is it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, but that's in Bucks County.
Boy, my geography really does stink, but you're in Philadelphia.
Yeah, we are right on the Poquessing Creek, which is the border, the northernmost border of Philadelphia, right on the river. So we look over across this small creek, and that's Bucks County.
So did the McAllister family keep it in the family for a long enough period? Because how did it manage to survive?
Well, the McAllisters kept it until 1895. Charles McAllister died in the late 1880s, and his daughter inherited it, and that was Lily McAllister, and she was quite the socialite, and she was instrumental in saving Mount Vernon. So we have a history of historic preservation in the house. Because she was part of the women's group that saved Mount Vernon down in outside of Washington. And so she lived there for quite a while until she died, and then it was sold in 1895. But we found a quote in the newspaper about Lily, and it said that she's known for her incredibly young husband. So she was apparently quite a character.
Oh, good grief. So, but then how did it survive? Because that's really part of the story today that I want to hear. How did this piece of our Philadelphia history manage to make it to 2021-22, you know, make it this long and still have doors open and still telling us the story of the people who came before us?
Well, it almost didn't make it. But I'll get to that in a second. Because that Lilly, after Lilly dies in the early 1890s, it's abandoned for a while. And then a gentleman named Robert Foderer purchased it in 1895. And this is a whole other story. Robert Foderer was a tanner, and he developed a process to tan goat skins that cut the tanning time in half and made them turn out like kid leather. So he entered his product into the 1893 Columbian Exposition, the World's Fair in Chicago, and won first prize for his in leather wares for his product. And in fact, we still have the glass cases that he displayed his leather ware in Chicago on display in the mansion. So he won this prize and became incredibly wealthy when women wore leather, kid leather gloves, had kid leather pocketbooks and shoes. And he had a factory in the Frankfurt area of Philadelphia that employed 3,000 employees and tanned 9 million goat skins a year. So it was not just a little leather tannery. It was quite the affair. And he became incredibly wealthy. And there's this story that he was in a boat with his wife before they became wealthy, and they took rowed by this boat or came by this by the house, and there's a sculpture of a dog right on the steps overlooking the Delaware River, and this is a it's not an actual sculpture of an actual dog, but it is a lawn ornament, but it is dedicated to McAllister's former dog who passed away and is buried in the front yard, Little Ugly. So there's a whole story about Little Ugly. Anyway, the Foderer saw this sculpture in the house, and they said, if we ever get wealthy, we should buy this house. And they did get wealthy, and they did buy this house.
And that's how it got its name, Glenn Furder Ford?
So...
jumping ahead.
There's more of a story to that, too. So the McAllisters named it Glengarry originally for their home in Scotland, the area that they came from in Scotland. And when the Foderers bought it, their name is F-O-E-R-D-E-R-E-R, Foderer, Germans. And so they shortened it and changed the name from Glengarry to Glen Ford, F-O-E-R-D. So, yeah, that's the whole story in itself, isn't it?
That's a story. So now they own the house. Lily has passed, supposedly, with a smile on her face. And now the Foderers have purchased the house. So we're getting into the early 20th century. How does it stay upright? Why wasn't it razed? Why wasn't it abandoned?
Well, it was abandoned when they bought it, and so in 1895, and so they had it for a number of years and started doing improvements and buying additional land around there. And Foderer becomes very wealthy, as I had suggested. His main house is on North Broad Street with all the other millionaires, like the Widners and the Elkins. And this was a weekend house that he was building, but it was more than that as well. So the original house was an Italianate-style mansion, and we don't really know the original architect, but it's very much in this Italianate style, you know, a very symmetrical building with arched windows and brackets and a cupola on the roof, a flat roof with a cupola on it. And so when they bought it, they gutted the entire house, I mean down to the walls, and rebuild it and then built an addition on the side. So it looks entirely different from the simple interiors that an Italianate 1850s house would have had. It's now a Gilded Age mansion with a grand staircase, a lay light over the stairs, decorative molding on all the ceilings, gold gilding, an art gallery they added on to the side, and a large dining room with the areas for three different dining room tables. And then they were nouveau riche, so they built an art gallery. Oh, now they need an art collection. So they bought an art collection. They bought a lot of art at auction in Philadelphia and traveled to Europe and also expanded the collection. So there's quite a nice art collection, but it also has some questionable paintings since I don't think that they were quite the connoisseurs that they had hoped to be. But so we have a Rembrandt that is, you know, probably extremely questionable. We have a Van Gogh that's not by Van Gogh, and you know there's Monet's. There's a number of paintings by well-known named artists that are in the files. It says attributed to or follower of or school of. So,
but you have them. How did they
we have them.
Again? How did you end up with the paintings and the house?
Right. So the only two families have ever lived here.
Oh, my goodness.
After all these years, only two families have ever lived in this house. So the McAllisters and then the Foderers. So the Foderers had two children, Florence and Percival. And so Percival is going to medical school at Penn. And his father had developed this tanning process, which required a lot of experimentation with chemicals.
Ooh.
And chromium was the chemical that he used to tan these skins that cut the process in half and probably seriously polluted the Frankford Creek and the Delaware in the process with his 3,000 employees. Prior to that, tanning was used, I believe it was like feces was used in the tanning process, like bat guano, and it was a nasty, nasty business. And I'm not saying the chemicals was better, but anyway, he becomes a U.S. Congressman. Foderer becomes a U.S. congressman, and he's on the boards of all of the big companies and the Union League member. But he dies in his early 40s, mid-40s, of Bright's disease, probably brought on by his chemical experimentations. Dies before the house is renovated, before it's finished being renovated. And so he never really sees it finished. So his son drops out of medical school, Percival, and takes over running the business. And Florence, the daughter and mother, end up living in the house after it's completed. The mother and daughter live there. Daughter gets married, and they have a house next door. Then mom dies, and they move into the house, and they continue with the renovations. There were greenhouses. There were, I mean, a huge staff. It was 20 acres, and that was left after the McAllister sold off some of the other lots. And Florence lives there until she dies in 1971. So it was a long history of two families living there. And so Florence's husband lives there, and he dies in the mid-40s. And then Florence lives there all by herself with all her servants until she dies in 1971.
Was it left then to a trust to become a house museum?
In her will, she left it to the Lutheran Church. So she had two adopted children and a fortune, and because they closed the factory down in the late 30s, and she wills it to the Lutheran Church. The kids get the money and don't want a huge mansion, which is probably understandable. And everything goes to the Lutheran Church, and the Lutherans use it for 10 years as a retreat. And then the Lutheran Church, I believe, goes bankrupt, but they have some financial issues, and it's a quite an expensive property to keep up. I can testify to that. They sell it to a developer who's going to bulldoze the house and build apartments. Like, this is in the 70s, so it would have been, you know, those regular row house apartment type situations. And the neighbors, so it's in a little cul-de-sac, and there's like two square blocks of neighbors who are just right next to it. It's a beautiful 18-acre arboretum, and the neighbors treasured it. And when they were appalled when they found it was going to be bulldozed, and they went and they looked at the will, and there was a stipulation in there that Florence put in that if the Lutheran Church didn't keep it, then it reverted to the community. And they sued the Lutheran Church and won. But they're a group of neighbors, you know, they couldn't really take ownership of it. So the city stepped in and took ownership of the property, and the neighbors formed a nonprofit that I work for that maintains it. So then the Glenn Ford Conservation Corporation runs and maintains the whole site. So the city owns it, but we take care of everything.
It's very reminiscent of the Maxwell Mansion in Germantown, where the neighbors took up a collection, literally change to save it from being a gas station, or the Merchant House in New York that stayed in the same family and kept the way it was. But Glenn Ford is more active. It's got a new life now. And that's how – that's the next chapter now.
Right.
Using it. And I'm going to – we're going to talk about that after I say that if you're just tuning in, this is Our Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today, Ross Mitchell, the executive director of Glenn Ford. And if you'd like to learn more about Glenn Ford, go to its website. It's glennford.org. And Ford, we just learned, is spelled F-O-E-R-D. So that's Glenn Ford, Glenn F-O-E-R-D. rd.org. However, if you do Google Glenn Ford, you don't just get the actor, you get you. So you are doing something right.
Yes.
And that's key, isn't it, to keeping this thing going. Why so many other house museums haven't flourished and aren't no longer even open to the public to tour. They're owned by some trust and they just sit. What do you do now? What's the purpose of the property today?
That's a very good question. We are incredibly fortunate because the neighbors, once they took control of it in the mid, I guess it was 1984, they asked themselves the same question. And it's such an unbelievably beautiful location right on the banks of the river with this 30,000 square foot mansion. They started having weddings there. So they did it themselves originally. You know, it's like they cooked the dinner for the bride and groom. They let the bride and groom sleep upstairs in the bedrooms. And they started raising money by making it in a very, very ad hoc kind of way a wedding venue. And now we receive over 75% of our income as a wedding venue. So we have weddings there. This year we've had weddings almost every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday evening. So it generates a great deal of our income and makes it possible for us to do other things to preserve the mansion.
You are part of the Fairmount Park system, technically, but you have to be self-supporting?
That's correct, yes. So the city owns the property, but we are responsible for basically 100% of all care and maintenance, upkeep, mowing the lawn, landscaping, you know, everything.
Okay, so now continue on. So 75% of the revenue is coming in from weddings, but that still leaves a gap, and those are private parties. You got the public into the houses, though.
Right. So you had mentioned about the historic house. I refer to it as the dilemma because Philadelphia has an embarrassment of riches of historic houses. And how do you support yourself as a historic house? I mean, that's just not enough. You know, the audience for historic properties is, you know, frankly, kind of limited. And, you know, we're open to the public now, and we don't even charge. We're open on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday mornings from 10 to 1, but we don't even charge. So my goal is to make Glenn Ford into a cultural destination by creating new and unique cultural events that make people want to come. So I'm willing to drive across the city to go to an event if it really attracts me, if it's a high quality event. And that's exactly what we're doing. And we're also, we reached out to the William Penn Foundation and we received a $500,000 grant to build a dock and to start a kayaking program. So it's a two-pronged approach, I would say. So it's through our environmental connections and through boating and boat building and then also through cultural events such as Ballet X has been performing there last year and they will be performing there again. We have a Fringe Festival performance that just finished up in September with Ego Poe Theater. We have a number of different entities that come and perform music. We had the Bismuth Quartet performed a quartet in different rooms throughout the house. All the players were in different rooms, and the music came together in the grand stairway. So it's through different kinds of programming that we're trying to attract people to our destination.
Well, you also, though, have a stewardship role because you are on the river. And so I know you're part of now the Riverways Collaboration.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So that is funded by the William Penn Foundation. Thank you, William Penn Foundation. And it is a consortium of different nonprofits that are on the river, including Bartram's Garden, the Independent Seaport Museum, Urban Promise in Camden, Glen Ford, the Land Health Institute. And so we received, I believe it's like a $350,000 grant for a three-year program of helping us all work together and to utilize and connect people with the riverfront. So that's part of our
mission. You have programming around that too. It's not just kayaking. We're going to start with the water and then we move onto the lawn and into the house.
Right. Yes. So we just hired our first full-time environmental program manager. And she's developing new programs that connect people with not just the river, but with our environment in general and with conservation thoughts and efforts.
So people can enjoy the water through Glen Ford.
We have a whole fleet of kayaks. I've kayaked across the river and up the Rancocas Creek. It's a wonderful program.
Then we're going to move to the lawn. You're an arboretum.
We're an 18-acre arboretum, historic arboretum. If only I had the funding that Chanticleer has, we could look something like that as well. But that's on the wish list. But we do have a lot of beautiful specimen trees, and we try to maintain it as best we can. And certainly a goal is to bring it up to the former glory that it once had.
Well, you're developing it. You're moving your way in. But then when someone visits the house now for a wedding or on a Friday, Saturday, or Sunday morning to see it, what are the attractions when you come inside? And then how do you lure people? Once you get them in there, they see the art. How do you keep them? Or how do you get young people to look around this house and say, oh, I would like to become a part of this ongoing history?
That's a really good question.
There was one in there.
Yes. we have an artist in residency program, and this is a wonderful way of bringing artists in to look at the property, at the site, the building, the collection, and to reinterpret it through creative eyes. So our most recent candidate, our artist in residence, Tabitha Arnold. She is a labor activist and a rug weaver. And so she did this beautiful installation looking at the history of tanning and the work and labor that the immigrants, a lot of Polish immigrants, did in the factory. And so we have these weavings that she's just completed. We had 72 applicants for this one artist in residence spot, and Tabitha was the winner, and her work really reflects the quality that she brings to the effort. So how do you reinterpret it? I mean, you know, we've moved all the furniture out of the first floor because we have wedding receptions there and it was getting damaged. So it is an open space. So people don't come to look at how people lived in the 1890s or in the 1920s, although we do have some rooms that are set up in that way. But it's through reinterpreting it that we're looking to bring people. And through these programs that attract younger audiences. We had, for Halloween, we had an immersive sandbox theater performance that a group, Altera, wrote and performed. And it was this interactive performance of a play they called The Poison Garden. And it was taking place in different rooms throughout the mansion, and the people had to follow them around, although different things were happening simultaneously. Oh, and by the way, the whole performance was spoken in gibberish. So we had an incredibly young audience for that. So we're doing performances and different theater aspects that attract younger audiences. And we have a lot of younger people who are members and who follow us.
What about the teens?
Yeah, so we received a $20,000 Connolly Foundation grant for a two-year program. In fact, the program just finished up. So we had 8 students from around the region. And they came every week and would work on art projects and interpreting the household and the building and the environment. And so I haven't even seen the end product yet, but I look forward to having it on display.
So is this a constant changing exhibit space?
Well, with the artists in residence projects, they're so site specific. I found that we've left them up because there's no reason to take them down because they're just so perfect where they are. So we have We have one in the bedroom upstairs by Cindy Stockton Moore, and it's interpreting Florence's bedroom. And it has, you know, watercolors that have been glued onto the wall, you know, but reversible, a video of her whole creative process. And she brought steamer trunks out of the carriage house and reinterpreted them. So, I mean, it's this, things just fit in. So, no, it's not necessarily a changing exhibit, but some come and go and move throughout the house.
We won't find a ballet ex-dancer like hanging out in the, you
know. No.
Right.
Although that would be nice.
That would be nice. That actually would be a really cool idea. So you work with Fringe Arts and Ballet X. So do you work with other organizations or do other city cultural offices use the property? Does the city ever use the property?
No, that's a good question. I hadn't even thought about that. No, the city does not use the property. But, I mean, they have so many different opportunities and other venues that they can use. I mean, I don't even know how they would use it. But we have a lot of partnerships. One of our close partnerships is with Riverfront North, and they oversee the trails north of Center City from Fishtown up to the Northeast. And the one program I haven't mentioned is our Waterborne program. And Waterborne is a boat building education program. And we just merged with an organization last summer. It's Philadelphia Waterborne. And we've taken it over now. And it is centered in our carriage house. We have this 8,000 square foot carriage house. And we have a whole boat building wood shop that we've set up in there. And the Waterborne program goes into schools and builds boats with middle school students, and in the process of building boats, it teaches them math skills. It teaches them leadership skills and teamwork and carpentry. And then the end product is getting them connected to the waterfront because we launch their boats that they've built with them. And a lot of these kids, you know, in North Philadelphia and different areas of the city have never even been to the riverfront or certainly out on the water. So it's this beautiful program that we are just starting up now. We have two classes running, one at Northeast High School and one at the Maritime Charter Academy.
That is wonderful. And I hate to say it, this is a two-minute warning. Bring us home. Talk about Glenn Ford. What sets you apart from, again, there are so many, you say that there's an embarrassment of riches in this city for historic homes, but I couldn't come up with a good list because they don't seem to be accessible, or they don't seem to be promoted, or they don't seem to be having activities. Are they even open? So what made Glenn Ford a winner out of this?
A lot of hard work. Because, you know, how do you support a historic house? Once again, I mean, it's such a challenge. I mean, so you need to think, I believe, that you need to think of other ways of activating the site. So we're so fortunate with the weddings. Jamie Hollander is our dedicated caterer. The weddings are not cheap, and we already have almost 90 weddings booked for 2022, and they're booking weddings into 2023. So this is incredibly fortunate for us, but it means that we can't use our own house, our own property, on weekends. So there's a challenge that we have, but we have been able to activate it by having events on weeknights and weekdays or Sunday, Saturday mornings. But, you know, it's through programmings and just getting the name out there, creating a buzz, I would say. You know, we have somebody dedicated to our social media postings. And on in October, I believe it's on October 22nd, 2022, we will be having the first ever Wedding Crashers Ball. Since we're also already set up as a venue for weddings, I'm going to hire a group of actors, and they are going to portray the wedding party and the bride and groom, and everything is going to go wrong. And so it will be an interactive wedding where all the guests will be wedding crasher guests.
Well, that sounds like fun, and we'll find out more information about that at your website, correct?
Correct.
And again, those weddings, only 75% of your revenue, because it takes a lot to keep that sucker going.
Yes.
For more information, whether you're interested in kayaking or you got the bucks for a big wedding, if you'd like to know more information about performances that are held at Glenn Ford, go to their website, glennford.org. Glenn Ford. F-O-E-R-D, glennford.org. My guest today, it's Executive Director for Glenn Ford, Ross Mitchell. Thank you for coming on today.
Thank you so much.
Great history lesson about Philadelphia.
Become a member of Glenn Ford and help support us.
And I'm going to guess you find that at the website, right?
Correct.
Oh, yeah. glennford.org. Again, Ross Mitchell, Executive Director of Glenn Ford, my guest. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been our Delaware Valley.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.